As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
Welcome. I want to thank you all for participating in Jewish Women International's National Alliance to End Domestic Abuse in the Jewish Community. Our organization of 75,000 member donors and supporters is dedicated to ensure that every girl and woman is safe in her home and in her relationships. JWI provides training, advocacy, and resources to promote safe homes, healthy relationships, and strong women. Our next speaker event will be our third international conference on domestic abuse in the Jewish community on Sunday, March 18th till Tuesday, March 20th, 2007 at the Hyatt Regency Hotel, Baltimore, Maryland. As was true of our last two conferences, we expect hundreds of attendees, including attorneys, advocates, social workers, clergy, survivors, and anyone who works with children and families. JWI's National Training Institute will present a special six-hour track on children exposed to domestic violence. Jackson Katz will open the conference as one of our keynote speakers, and Elizabeth Vermilia and Jeff Edelson will be doing the track on the children exposed to DV. Information is posted on our website, and registration is now open. Social workers will be happy to know that we are able to get up to 30 CEs for the conference. National Alliance members will meet as a group at the conference and will have an opportunity to both network and plan next year's events. We are delighted to announce that NASW has joined with JWI's National Alliance and our Training Institute to provide training and education to social workers who work with abused women and children. We will provide one social work CE contact for each of our conference calls. The cost for the certificate is $10. If you haven't signed up and are listening with a friend or colleague, kindly send me an email with your name and contact information so we can send you information regarding upcoming calls and our e-newsletter. We ask that you register each month for these calls so that we know what programs are of interest to you and can show our funders why they should continue to support them. I will send you an evaluation form at the end of this call. Please return it to me. If you wish CEs or CDs, please complete the entire form and follow the directions. We ask that everyone fill out the evaluation and email it back with your comments. The forms are also available on our website under the heading National Alliance, and our website is www.jwi.org. Today's call is being recorded, and because we have so many people participating on this call, we've put all of the phones on mute, and they will remain on mute for the entire call. So again, if you have questions that come up as you're listening to the presentation, please email them to me at gelias@jwi.org. Today's call is Betraying the Trust, Rabbis and Child Sex Abuse. We will explore the issue of child sex abuse by clergy. While we know that child sex abuse happens in all communities, the purpose of this call is to bring changes in the ways that the legal system, the community, and the rabbinic leaders treat victims and handle allegations. The presenters on this call all appeared on ABC's Nightline on October 11, 2006. So we are so pleased to have with us Mark Weiss, who is a child survivor. He is a speaker on this issue and an advocate for children. Michael Lesher, who is an attorney and writer, who has campaigned about child sex abuse inside and outside the Jewish community. He has published investigative and opinion journalism on this issue. He has litigated in state and federal court on behalf of abused children all across the country. Amy Neustein, Ph.D., sociologist, author, researcher, and daughter of a prominent Orthodox rabbi from Brooklyn, has devoted two decades to studying the plight of Jewish victims of clerical child sexual abuse and the community's treatment of its victims. Rabbi Mark Dratch, who is founder and CEO of JSAFE, the Jewish Institute Supporting an Abuse-Free Environment. He is an instructor of Jewish studies at Yeshiva University. He is active in many Jewish and interfaith organizations dealing with all forms of abuse. And we are proud to say that he is also a member of JWI's National Clergy Task Force. We also want to acknowledge the leadership of other members of our National Clergy Task Force who are on this call, Rabbi Ira Yudovin, Rabbi David Rose, and Rabbi Ron Muroff. And now I'm going to turn this program over to Rabbi Mark Dratch.
Okay, thank you very much. The issue of child sexual abuse by rabbis and by clergy is a very, very difficult one. It really flies in the face of everything that we expect from our respected religious leaders and that we expect of our community. Already 2,000 years ago in the Talmud, quoting the verse from the prophet Malachi, the verse says, "Ki malach Hashem tzevakotu v'tara yivakesh mipihu," that teachers of religious instructors, religious spiritual leaders, are compared to angels of God. And the Talmud tells us that only if they act in angelic ways, only if they really are spiritual and moral exemplars, are we to respect them as leaders and turn to them. Unfortunately, we know all too well that despite what we'd like to think about our community, we have all sorts of problems, and that includes rabbinic sexual abuse. We don't have good numbers. We know that there are many cases. Most of them go unreported. We know that there are cases of rabbinic sexual abuse in all denominations, Reform, Orthodox, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Renewal, all across the spectrum. We know also that the nuances in terms of how things are perpetrated and then how the community responds may be nuanced by that denomination, by its religious affiliations, by its theological biases. And those are issues that I'm sure will come up in our discussion during this hour. Abuse is by all types of clergy, by rabbis, by cantors, by teachers, by counselors, by other types of professionals. And the impact that they have on the victims, the kind of trauma that is felt, whether it's the sexual violation, the emotional and psychological ramifications, the spiritual ramifications, because a child who is abused by a rabbi is not only having his or her body violated, but is having his or her soul violated as well. And that has tremendous impact on how that child will grow into adulthood, how that child will be able to be one day a husband or a wife or a friend or a parent or a professional, and what kind of Jew, what the person's relationship with God and with the community is going to be about. And so there's a wonderful agenda ahead of us, and this is merely an introduction trying to lay out the issue in a very, very general overview. And I hope that as we make our presentations and the questions come in, we'll be able to address many significant issues. Thank you.
Rabbi Dratch. Mark Weiss, would you? Mark?
Hello, I'm here.
Great.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. I would also like to echo the sentiment and thank each and every one of you for taking time from your undoubtedly busy schedule to participate in the discussion of this important topic, and I might add often ignored topic of child sexual abuse. I hope my story will serve as some sort of inspiration and wake-up call or continuation to action on behalf of the people and the organizations that you represent. My story, basically, I grew up in a very religious home. My parents were prominent educators in a very famous community in Chicago, and very nice people, good people. Unfortunately, some pre-adolescent boys out there was having trouble finding my place in the world. I was not what you call a troubled child, but I was, just having issues just in dealing with things in the way they were presented to me, certainly within that environment. And I failed to fit the mold of, like, the typical yeshiva boy. And as I progressed into high school, I ended up being shifted around to several of yeshivas in search of a place that would be a good match. Because of the different attitude that I was taking and such, I was having trouble fitting in. And my father, my parents had decided to try to get me some counseling on the matter. Now, I should add that the subject or the person that abused me was a very famous individual known as Avraham Mondravitz, or Mondrowitz, people call him. We essentially grew up, we were living in Chicago, and this individual grew up in Chicago as well. He was a student at the yeshiva where my father taught, and my father and I actually, this Mondravitz's father used to be a rabbi of a small shul that my father and I used to frequent very often. And so this was a person who was familiar to us. And when he grew up, this individual was about 20 years older than me. And, you know, he ultimately got married and moved to New York, where he became well-known in the circles of the Orthodox and right-wing Orthodox community as a very successful psychologist and guidance counselor for troubled youth. So my father ended up sending me there, and so that whole saga began. Basically, his entire family, as is customary in New York City, a lot of people go away for summer up to the Catskill Mountains, and so his family very conveniently was away. And so he picked me up from the airport in his fancy little sports car with his cool stereo, and he was a very, very non-typical right-wing Orthodox Jew for me, certainly. He was, he seemed to be cool and hip, and he took me out to restaurants, and he took me to an amusement park, and, you know, basically gave me some tremendous attention, and this was all new stuff for me. So, you know, I was loving it. And because I was also grew up very naive and very sheltered, the whole subject of anything to do with sexual anything was really very taboo. So in the circles I grew up in, it just was never really talked about. So consequently, that the evenings that I spent with him, I did spend at his house. And when, you know, he offered me where I was going to be sleeping in the apartment. So the options were, of course, you know, one of his kids' rooms. And he also offered to me for me to sleep with him. And, of course, made it very appealing. And I didn't think any reason to suspect that there was anything amiss. So I ended up, you know, ultimately being convinced to do that with him. And ultimately, what ensued was the fact that I was sexually molested for the next for the duration of the week that I was with him. And the thing is that it never even registered really that anything that was going on was wrong, because you know, again, he was familiar and he certainly looked the part of a pious individual, and all this extra contact, which didn't register at all on my scale, was just viewed as somebody being very warm and very loving and very friendly. And, you know, obviously it was not the case. So the thing is, though, is that because nothing ever registered, I simply did not realize that anything had happened. And so when I came home, I didn't tell anybody about this. And so the years went by, and then it wasn't until I was 18 years old, and then I happened to be home from an extended stay in Israel, where I was going to school at that time, and I was home, and it was actually over the Sukkot holiday. I was in shul, and I looked across the room, and I happened to see Avremel Mondravitz sitting there in shul. And I basically said to myself, let me go say hello to him. I haven't seen him in many years. And as I started to walk over there, it suddenly hit me like a ton of bricks what had happened. And I had just sort of repressed the whole story up until the time that I actually saw him. And so I was very upset. I immediately spun around and left Shoal, and I went home very upset and crying. And because I had arrived home early, my mother answered the door and was surprised to see me, and of course asked me what happened, and she saw I was upset. And so I told her what happened, and I remember the reaction of my mother was just total disbelief. Like, you know, she was like, "What? How could you say that? He's we know him. It couldn't be." So on and so forth. There was a lot of doubt. And then my father ultimately came home shortly thereafter, and I could hear them speaking. And I'm sure my mother explained to him what I had said. My father came over to me and sort of echoed the same sentiment as my mother, and I remember they just were having a very, very tough time. And, you know, understandably so, you know, now that I could look at it many years later, my parents were completely unexposed to this type of thing, and this type of corruption in the community was something just certainly nothing they had heard of. And so here was a child making a very serious allegation to somebody they had known for a long time. So they found it very tough to believe. So the particular story sort of settled for about a week, and then I got a call from one of my father's colleagues, who was the dean of the school my father, the yeshiva that my father taught at. He called me to his home, and he sat me down. And I was 18 years old at the time, so of course I was not married, etc. And the rabbi asked me a very simple and pointed question. He asked me if I would trust my children with Avremel Mandarovitz. So after I got over the initial shock of the question, just because I had no idea why I was going there, I immediately realized that, you know, this was essentially his modest and, sneas or also a form of modest manner of asking a naive yeshiva boy growing up in a right-wing world if I was sexually molested. So I responded to him, of course, that absolutely I would not trust my children, and then proceeded to tell him everything that had happened, and he essentially debriefed me on that whole thing. And that unfortunately ends the story, though, for that particular period of my life. And there was never any follow-through, which again I look upon today, which this is a person who I grew up with, also this rabbi, and I'm still obviously very close to these days. But it was something that always has bothered me, is the fact that there was really no follow-up, and, you know, you just sort of drop the bomb on a young kid and so on, and essentially validated what the story was. So that, unfortunately, was very troubling and still continues to be troubling today. That being said, however, I should say that I do feel that there is a tremendous amount of progress being made. There are all sorts of organizations, certainly the one that Rabbi Dratch is involved with, and I've been involved in discussions that I've had for the Nefesh Conference. Nefesh is the Organization of Orthodox Mental Health Professionals, which I was a presenter at. There's the OHEL organization. There was a video that I participated in. Anyway, I think that we are definitely making progress, and of course there are numerous other organizations which I either don't know about or I'm too numerous to mention. I feel very encouraged that people are finally taking notice. In terms of its fallout for me and my family, the good news is that I have always been very open about this with my wife and my children. I told about this story to my wife before we were actually engaged to be married. So I wanted that to be right out there on the table right from the beginning. I feel that also, you know, by my telling my children about this, my children have pretty much from an age where they could fully understand what this ramification is, the ramifications of the story is, they have always been They have always been, they have always known about this, and consequently, they have been empowered to deal with the whole thing. They also, you know, there is no shame with my children. You know, it's a taboo subject. It's a taboo subject for a lot of people, but not in my family. And so, the thing that I like about that is the fact that I could feel a bit perhaps more secure that my children, I've done everything to protect my children, you know, from this happening to them. And, you know, obviously this is a subject out in the public. And so I've taught my children that if other people talk to them about this or try to, you know, their friends say anything derogatory, to just be strong and you know, stick up for what's right. I have recently, in light of a very recent story that has come to light in the media in one of the Jewish institutions in Brooklyn recently, this sort of set off what I've been waiting for a very, very long time to do, which is it's set off a whole, you know, advocacy sentiment on my part. I really feel the time has come for me to really do something about this. So if you probably have seen other articles that I have done, et cetera, and I intend to do so. The whole idea is not to embarrass people and not to embarrass the organizations or the rabbinic leadership. I don't think there's a rabbinic rabbi out there who condones any of this type of behavior and who isn't completely horrified that this is even happening. But however, I feel that the ways that things are dealt with, unfortunately, could be modified and we could be more progressive. I intend to try to start an organization myself that will include a hotline that children and adults who are in trouble with this can be able to call. That's my hopes and dreams, and we're all in this together, and I hope we can affect positive change as soon as we can, because as we are talking about this, there are children out there who are being hurt, and it's got to stop.
Mark, thank you so much for sharing your story. Now we'll hear from Michael Lesher. Michael?
Thank you, Jerry, and I want to thank everybody who's participating in this call. It is, as Mark said, an important topic for us to be discussing, and it's a many-sided topic, which I guess my presence on the call tends to indicate. I always introduce myself as a writer and a lawyer. Writer first, I'm doing plenty of legal work these days. Writers tend not to be great talkers. I'm going to try to keep my remarks now to a minimum, leave as much time for questions as possible. I'm sure there will be. And legal issues can be, on the whole, a bit dry, though I did notice we got at least one lawyer checking into this call, and if you're dealing with people who are going to be victims, who are victims of abuse, when you deal with them, you will often have to address legal issues. I want to talk just for a minute about the Mondrowitz case itself, which Mark was discussing a minute ago, because I'm right in the middle of that, representing six people who were victims of his, because those issues do affect many other cases, and because they help to point ways that we might deal with some of these matters differently and better in the future. And first of all,
Michael, could you speak a little bit louder? We're having some difficulty hearing you.
Sure. Is this better?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's going to be very important in these cases generally, and it was a case that arose front and center in the Mondrowitz case, is the question of limitations, the question of how long you can wait before criminal charges, or for that matter, a civil action against the perpetrator can be filed. Believe me, it is not a dry and technical issue when you have people come to you, as I do, speaking to me on the phone or coming to me in person, talking about things that happened to them 20 years ago, and watching them choke up with emotion, having them say to me, it's difficult even for them to come and talk to me about it because having to do it now brings it up again and they have to go through it again. These things don't die for the victims, and therefore it's important that they not die for the legal system as much as possible. Now, in the Mondrowitz case, one of the first things that people ask me when I tell them that I'm working with people who were abused some 22 years ago is, well, gosh, wasn't that a long time ago? Surely the man can't be tried anymore for those offenses. In this case, the answer is very simple, that he can be. And the moral of the story I'm going to tell, and I'll repeat it after I go through a few facts, is that when it comes to legal issues, you can't make assumptions. You need to look at the law, consult someone who knows the law. This is something I do for people all the time. And find out what the specifics are, because these issues aren't simple. The statute of limitations is satisfied as soon as criminal charges are filed against the defendant. In this case, criminal charges were filed against Avraham Mondrowicz not long after the incidents that were alleged to, that he was alleged to have committed back in the 80s. And that makes that a live prosecution. The statute of limitations was satisfied, it remains satisfied. There is, however, another legal issue which people often tend to conflate with the former, and that is that defendants have a right to have their trial come on in speedy fashion. That is a requirement that in turn depends upon the United States Constitution. In this case, however, that's not a bar either, even though we've been waiting for 20 years, because in New York, the speedy trial requirement, the time for the speedy trial requirement doesn't even begin to run while the defendant remains outside the jurisdiction. Mondrowicz, in this case, fled the country and went to Israel, where he's been staying since. Now, what my effort has been about has been to try to bring Mondrowicz back for prosecution here in New York. That brings in a whole set of new issues that have to do with extradition, which I think I'll omit from this discussion, though it may indeed come up. The district attorney in Brooklyn, Charles Hines, has taken the position when he talks to reporters about this at all, which is rare, that Mondrowicz cannot be extradited. It's my opinion and the opinion of everybody who's been quoted in the newspapers and press about this, that he's dead wrong. He can be extradited, and in my view, he will be one day, and indeed we will get this done, and we will get the man prosecuted for what he did. One of the legal things I'd like this case to stand for in the future is that while you may run, you can't hide. But so far, he has in fact escaped prosecution. Let me anticipate one possible question right at the outset by saying that because I do, in the work I do, call much public attention to abuse cases that arise within the Jewish community. I have received some opposition. I've also received a heartening amount of support. I've been very pleased to see how many people, how many grassroots, at the grassroots level in particular, really want to see cases like this pushed forward. And part of the lesson, the moral, as I said at the beginning of all this, is that these rules are not simple. And part of what you've got to know when you're a victim or when you're counseling a victim is, you must know what your rights are. For example, there is a new trend throughout the United States to liberalize the statutes of limitation for sex abuse victims. In the state I live in, New Jersey, this state has adopted a remarkable new rule that allows you to start the clock running, not from when the abuse occurred, but from the time that the damage, the psychological damage that was caused to you by the abuse, is determined, which means, as a practical matter, that if you're in therapy, or if you're a therapist and you've got someone in therapy who remembers at a certain point being sexually abused and becomes fully aware through therapy of how what this effect was on him or her, you can now bring an action. And in fact, this has happened. We've already had an action of this nature that's getting a lot of attention for other reasons, too, that is being pursued in the state of New Jersey. That's a new trend. Most states don't have it. It's something that, to the extent we're in contact with lawmakers, we can talk about and have them think about. Because I would bet that if you're a therapist dealing with abuse victims, your experience coincides with mine. That 20 years later, maybe when they really find out what was done to them, what the effects of it were, and it may be the right thing to start counting from then, not at a time when they were children. Even in states that don't have that, there are often provisions that allow you to add time because you were a minor at the time, because you hadn't reached the age of 18. There are provisions that allow you to add time because you, as in this case, the defendant is outside the jurisdiction. How long that can be depends upon the jurisdiction, upon the rules of the state, and so on. So these are things you always want to follow. Last piece of advice I have to mention right here and now, because every case can be different, is, I said it before, but I want to amplify on it now. The victim needs to know what his rights are. I wish I could tell you I'm speaking from experience as well as from education. I wish I could tell you that every time you walk into the office of the district attorney or prosecutor, you're going to be met with complete sympathy and with a complete understanding of what your rights are. It isn't always so. Prosecutors are, though we don't always think of it this way, politicians. They are susceptible to political pressures. And there can be, and in many cases there are, pressures that tend to make them reluctant to prosecute certain kinds of cases, of which this is definitely one. We need to let them know, individual victims and as a community, that lots of us want to see these cases pursued. Lots of us want to see victims' rights vindicated. In the state of New York, for example, there is a law, specific statutory law, that the district attorney must have procedures in place to protect victims and witnesses from abuse, from intimidation. This was put on the books really because of organized crime and gangs. But it has an application where the victims may be coming from communities that may subject them to different kinds of intimidation, sometimes more subtle. It's my belief that this is something that a district attorney that has a community like this, for example in Brooklyn, needs to put in place. People have to be there who understand the situation of people from the Jewish community, what they may face, the kinds of pressures that may be placed on them. They are also legally obligated, for example, in a case of child abuse, to consult with the family before they drop a case. I'm aware of a couple of cases of child abuse in the Jewish community in Brooklyn in which Charles Hines, the district attorney's office, did not, in fact, consult with the victim's families before dropping charges. That's wrong. He's supposed to do that. Under the law, he's supposed to do that. If we, as victims and victims' advocates, know that, we can help to make the system work the best way it can. And with that, I think I'll pass on to the next presenter.
Thank you, Michael. Amy?
Yes, hello. I want to thank everyone for giving me the opportunity to share some insights with this group of therapists and attorneys and child advocates from all over the country. As a sociologist, I want to address a few things that I think have to be considered when analyzing the dynamics of child sexual abuse in the Jewish community today. One thing that I think we need to look at is the fact that we have two things operating at the same time. One feature is this massive denial in the community of that there is sexual abuse. Sandra Butler, for example, in a 1999 article in the Journal of Religion and Abuse, stated, quote, "One urgent concern I have is that there are many in the rabbinic leadership who still hold tightly to the illusion, not here, not them, not us, when faced with alleged sexual abuse in families and yeshivas and synagogues, etc." That sentiment is echoed by Joan Featherman, a Massachusetts psychologist and contributor to a 1995 book called Sexual Abuse in Nine North American Cultures, in which she states the myths surrounding the existence of sexual abuse in the Jewish community leave children, male and female, unprepared to identify early warning signals related to abuse. So because you have denial of abuse, of the existence of abuse, if there is abuse and a child reports it, it's very difficult to be believed. So you have the denial operating on one level. On another level, there is an aggressive campaign of suppression of sexual abuse. This was attested to by Rabbi Mordechai Glick, who is he's a clinical psychologist as well as a rabbi, and one of the other speakers mentioned the organization Nefesh. Rabbi Glick is the vice president of Nefesh, which is an international organization. It also includes Canadian professionals as well in the area of mental health, and it's in the Orthodox Jewish community. And Rabbi Glick, in a letter to the Jewish press in the year 2000, stated, quote, "If the police do get involved, a massive cover-up and pressure campaign usually ensures that the case will either not get to trial, or if it does, it will be dropped because potential witnesses are pressured," and he puts in parentheses, "code for threatened," close quote, close parentheses, "to refuse to testify or to outright lie." So what you have is, on one level, there's the myth that it's not happening, and so people will not believe the victim. On another level, you have a well-orchestrated campaign to suppress the abuse by influencing district attorneys in different pockets in the country where you have strong Jewish voting power. What I think one should examine is, are the effects of the victimization of children in the Jewish communities. Rabbi Dratch spoke quite astutely at the beginning of this session about the psychological trauma as well as the spiritual trauma. I was particularly struck by the spiritual trauma because in my interviewing victims across the different communities across the country over a 20-year period, what I have found is that Jews who are abused feel disaffected. I call this kind of the disaffected Jew phenomenon, where they don't feel that they're part of the community. The betrayal seeps so deeply into their spiritual life, into their soul, that they feel nomadic. They're like nomads. They have no place to hang their hat. I was particularly struck by a letter that I read that was published in Rabbi David R. Blumenthal's book several years ago called Facing the Abusing God, A Theology of Protest, where an abuse victim wrote to Rabbi Blumenthal, and he summed it up so well. Dear David, I'm beginning to see why I try to be observant, but have not davened, prayed, for 2 years, except to say, please be patient with me. For now I have nothing to say to God, because like all abused as children, I expect no response that will help. He offers no comfort, only stress and complication. This is a very common reaction of abuse survivors. They have nowhere to turn. They feel their relation with God has been ruptured. They feel their relationship with the community has been ruptured. And in many instances, their feelings are absolutely correct in that when you have the campaign of suppression that kicks in order to prevent the abuse from surfacing, the victims become subject to extreme forms of ostracism. Several years ago, there was an article that explained the ostracism over in England, in Stamford Hills, England, where there was a case like the Mondrowitz case, in which a rabbi was very well known, abused a number of children. There was a big public trial. And the family was subject to, they were driven out of their homes in the middle of the night by a mob of 300 Hasidic Jewish followers who threw missiles into the home, just like that was done in the South with those who tried to protest segregation. And the family was driven away. That's in Stamford Hills. My co-writer, Michael Lesher, and I studied a case in Brooklyn several years ago in which the family tried to seek the assistance of the Brooklyn District Attorney. Case was already before the grand jury, and the alleged abuser had been charged with 96 counts of child abuse, which is very serious. And in spite of all that, a rabbinic court convened, and in spite of all the grand jury testimony that had been heard by leading experts in New York, including the director of the sex abuse program at Mount Sinai Hospital, the case was pulled from the grand jury, and the family was driven out of Brooklyn. They had to find refuge outside of the New York City area because of the extreme form of ostracism and shame. This is something that is this is something that unfortunately is endemic. It's intrinsic to the Jewish community in terms of our response and treatment of victims. The last point I want to say, and I want to wrap this up because I know we want time for a lot of questions, is that there are gender differences, and what I've observed is that one of the concerns about the abuse of children in the Jewish community is that if boys are abused, The fear that has been articulated to me by a number of rabbis is that the Jewish community is concerned that particularly the Orthodox community, that it might come out that there's homosexuality in the community, and that would be embarrassing. There's also the concern that through the abuse of boys, there might be sort of the instigation or cultivation of homosexual tendencies as a result. And of course, that's subject for the for another talk at another time, and that's certainly that brings up many other issues. But there is this overriding fear about homosexuality being ascribed to Orthodox rabbis, and that is one of the strong concerns about abuse. With female children that are abused, one of the things that does happen is that it's hard for girls to get a good marriage mate if they admit that they are abuse victims. If they're Orthodox, the shatran, the marriage broker, will see the child as having a deficit because of the abuse trauma. So basically, instead of seeing the abuse as a community problem and something that we must address, the blame is shifted to the victim, and now the victim is walking around scarred, and the victim must make himself whole, and then and often the victim cannot do that once the stigma is affixed to the victim. In sociology, we call that a master status, where one status overrides all other identifying criteria. So an abuse victim has this master status of being an abuse victim. Where do we go from here? It's a complex problem. I'd say where we go from here is honesty, openness, proactive instead of reactive responses of the community. If we cannot exercise restraint with regard to ostracism and shaming victims, blaming victims, if we could just embrace a higher level of moral ethics, I think that we're halfway there. And I think the fact that this forum has been put together today, and I thank Jerry Elias for her hard work with putting this together, I think the fact that we're pulling together professionals from all different pockets in the country, and I think that that is really a very, very good first sign, that first step, toward toward rectifying this problem. And I thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak.
Thank you so much, Amy. And now, Rabbi Dratch.
Okay, thank you very much. My job is to speak about various issues in the synagogue communities, the community in general, and then next steps, and I will try to do that rather efficiently. There are some, I think, very important systemic issues that we need to address in dealing with the issue of child sexual abuse by rabbis. Number one, it needs to be understood, and I imagine that the overwhelming majority of the rabbinic community and the Jewish community is on board with the obligation of mandatory reporting. Across the board, certainly in the more liberal parts of the community and in large parts of the Orthodox community, the rabbinic organizations have affirmed and reaffirmed their desire and their obligation to report suspicions of abuse. It continues to be somewhat of an issue in the more right-wing Orthodox community, and there the positions are not monolithic, although they are subject to some of the pressures that Dr. Neustein had mentioned. So I think that's important to say. The problem is, I think, when a young victim or an adult who had been victimized in his or her youth comes to the Jewish community for support and doesn't go directly to the police or to some kind of social service agency, that they're subject to really the whims of the people that they speak to. If they're fortunate to have a rabbi or a community that is sensitive to the issue and knows how to respond appropriately, then they're in good shape. Too many rabbis, unfortunately, are not properly trained in this area and can make very big mistakes in listening, in responding, and in moving things forward. If there's a problem of child sexual abuse within a specific congregation, then it brings in not only the rabbi, but it brings in the entire community. And then synagogues take sides. Those who are, if it's the rabbi or the cantor, who are his supporters, who do not believe that that he or she could have done anything of this nature, this caliber, and they demonize the reporters and those who support the reporters, And there are those who support the reporters and become, you know, advocates against the rabbi. And very often, the entire community becomes polarized as a result. This is true within the individual congregation, and then it can be extrapolated to the larger umbrella organization, whether it's a synagogue body or it's a rabbinic organization. All of our rabbinic organizations, Reform, Orthodox, Conservative, have, or the modern Orthodox group anyway, have policies in place in terms of what's expected, appropriate behavior, comportment of their member rabbis, and what needs to be done by that rabbinic organization if allegations are made against a member rabbi. The problem is that very often these groups don't have, are not totally objective, that there are conflicts of interest that exist in terms of knowing the colleague, and in many cases these colleagues are very prominent and are very dear friends and have long histories with those who may have to investigate them or judge them as part of the rabbinic organization. There's conflicts of interest because there's concern about the integrity of that particular rabbinic organization or about Judaism in general. How will people look at us? What will they think of us? How will we be perceived by the non-Orthodox or the non-Reform or the non-Conservative or by the larger non-Jewish community? There's one rabbinic organization that actually suggests that the synagogue that has this rabbi who is being investigated or is being who has been accused, that the synagogue actually hire a media consultant to know how to talk to the community and how to talk to its members. So this is one of the, so even where there's good intentions, and I believe in many cases, in large parts of our community, there are good intentions to do the right thing, without the proper training, without the proper objectivity, without the proper context, things can become problematic. Even understanding the nature of mandatory reporting, I've heard in many cases where a school or a synagogue may receive a report and then say, well, but it doesn't, we're not quite convinced that it rises to the level where we're actually mandated to report. And that becomes an issue, an important issue as well. On the communal issue, not dealing with the issues of pressure that have been discussed before, people very often ask, are we like the Catholic, is a Jewish community like the Catholic Church? In the New York Magazine article that appeared a number of months ago, that was the headline on the cover. Now, does Judaism have a Catholic Church clergy problem, or whatever exactly it said? There are some very fundamental differences between the church on the one hand and the Jewish community on the other, which play important roles. Here. I think the major difference is that the Catholic Church has a hierarchy. There is, it's very well organized, and there is accountability from one level to another, and the individual parishes are responsible and accountable and answerable to those that come above them. And so as an outsider, I can't speak about the Catholic Church, and I'm told by insiders that it actually works better on paper than it does in reality. But it's my impression as an outsider that if the right kinds of messages and policies and accountability would come from on high, that could translate much more, very easily, as easy as any of these things are, down to the bottom of, to the individual parishes and the individual communities. Judaism, as we know, is very, very different. We have no hierarchy. We are very unorganized and disorganized. Just parenthetically, they tell the story of a rabbi who met a man in the street, and he invited him to come to synagogue on the Sabbath. And the man said to him, "Rabbi, I don't come. I don't believe in organized religion." To which the rabbi said, "Come to my synagogue. We're very unorganized." It's a bad rabbinic joke. I apologize. But we don't have that kind of structure. As a result, individual synagogues are not necessarily responsible, accountable, or answerable to a larger organization, and therefore, things are only as good as they happen in individual places. There are that being said, there are policies in place within some of the denominational movements as to what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and how things are to be handled, and they work good or not as good. On paper, in some instances on paper, it looks better than in practice. Sometimes it's good, and my impression is sometimes it's good, and sometimes it's not. That being said, You know, because we are a very tight-knit community, and because social pressure plays a large role, especially in the more traditional communities, there's almost a conspiracy, whereas in the church there may be a conspiracy of the hierarchy of the authorities, within certain parts of our community there can be a conspiracy of the community, and the pressure not to speak up, not to report to civil authorities, not to deal with the outside, and that plays a very significant and important role. So with regard to next steps and what I think needs to be done and what we can do, I think there are a number of things, and I'll just list them quickly, and then we'll get to our questions. Number one is what we're doing now and then beyond. There needs to be public discussion. I think the more we expose the issue of rabbinic sexual abuse, the more we say that we're no longer going to tolerate hiding it or covering it up or suppressing it, the more of a chance we have of dealing with those victims who presently exist and creating the opportunity for victims to come forward and talk to us, because they know they're going to get a hearing and they're going to be trusted and believed, and something is going to be something's going to be done. Number two, there needs to be training for rabbis and for community leaders, so that if somebody does come with a disclosure, they'll know the proper ways of responding. They'll know how to ask questions or not to ask questions, what to say, what not to say. And they'll be aware of the network of wonderful people that are available to help support them and the people that have come to them to make these kinds of disclosures. There needs to be policies in place, and see, real policies that don't exist just on paper, but are understood by rabbis, by the lay leadership, by the employees of a congregation, as to behavior that's acceptable and not acceptable, and what the procedures will be if there's a complaint, and how things are going to be dealt with. There needs to be accountability to larger organizations than just the individual congregations. There need to be prevention programs, educational programs in our schools, in our youth groups, in our camps, so that the situation that Mark described, saying, I didn't know what this was about, and I didn't know that it was wrong, cannot happen again, and that perhaps we can help prevent many problems from occurring. There need to be policies in place in individual synagogues as to what appropriate comportment of a rabbi or a cantor or a teacher or a youth leader is, so that that a rabbi won't be in a room alone with somebody with the door locked or the door closed and with no windows, or the youth leader won't be able to be alone in the building or take somebody home late at night and it's in a one-on-one situation. What kinds of touch is acceptable or not acceptable? What kinds of discussions or language is acceptable or unacceptable? We need to create working relationships with the religious communities, with law enforcement, with the judicial community, with advocates, with the social service agencies, so that when an issue does exist, a victim can be plugged into the system. Various parts of the system can understand each other, can have cultural and religious sensitivity, and the trust can be built up, so that the rabbis or the community won't be afraid to make a referral to a social service agency, because they've worked together, they know each other, there's mutual respect there as well. This is just a very brief laundry list of things that can be done, in addition to the changes in the legal system and other things that have been discussed in this call previously. So I thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Dratch. And I want to thank our other presenters, Mark Weiss, Michael Lesher, Amy Neustein, for your very thoughtful, candid presentation of these issues. It's a very difficult conversation for us all to have, but it is a necessary one. And now I want to ask a few questions. The first one is a question for Mark Weiss. Looking back, was there anything that a medical provider could have done or asked during a routine medical checkup that would have helped you in making a disclosure about your abuse? And it could be a parent, school teacher, trusted adult. Are you there, Mark?
Can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Yes, now we can hear you.
Okay. All right. So can I ask you to repeat the question, please?
Sure. Was there anything that a medical provider could have done or asked during a routine medical checkup that would have helped you make a verbal disclosure about your abuse? And this could be about a parent, teacher, or a trusted adult.
Yeah. Okay, so the answer, in my opinion, is yes, and this kind of is the flip side of what, in my opinion, is a wise thing to teach a child, is if you teach a child that it basically it's hands off in any areas covered by a bathing suit, that was not my idea. I've heard that from other people, but that's a very, very... It gets right to the area in question, but it keeps it dignified too, so that you don't have to start getting into all the back and forth about why no one touches you in the genital area, that whole thing. So I think that sure, if I was questioned by a physician or you know any of the other people you mentioned, whether anybody has touched me in that way. One other thing also, which I very strongly believe could be asked, and this again is to be taught to children, is that children are to be taught that they are not to keep secrets from their parents. So if they are put in a position where somebody is telling them it's going to be between you and me, so even if they don't immediately come out, you know, for example, they're threatened or what have you, and they have reason not to immediately spill the beans to their parents, I think that at least if that thought has been put in place in a child to begin with, then certainly it would be an easier nut to crack when you realize that a child is in trouble. So I think that. Those two questions probably could, unearth some information from a child, with regard to this.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mark. And Rabbi Dratch, are there any programs, continuing education relating to child sexual issues for Jewish organizations that are proactive, preventative, and ongoing in nature?
I think there are a number of things that are happening, and I think more needs to be developed. You now have in almost all of the rabbinical schools pastoral training and training in these areas. Some places are better than others, but we're beginning to see that. You have on. Programs that I'm aware of are actually for older, really for older children, begin with the teenage years and then beyond. JWY itself has a wonderful tape on dating violence, but things that can be extrapolated from there. You have from Faith Trust Institute, you have from JWY, you have from a number of these places, from Sidron Institute in Baltimore, programs to deal with these kinds of issues. Some of them are generalized and can be adapted for Jewish programs, and I think more needs to be developed in these areas.
Thank you. And I think we'll end it on that. I have actually one more question for you, Rabbi Dratch. Are there any written protocols or guidelines, hotlines, or instructions for Jewish organizations or agencies that provide assistance and appropriately refer worried, concerned parents or their children once the sexual abuse issues arise?
Right. Well, I mean, I think the best...
Same places?
Mm-hmm. The same. Well, no. I would answer differently in that case. Most of our communities have Jewish family services or other kinds of social service agencies that are either uniquely Jewish or that serve the general community. And I would argue that's probably the first place to turn. There are national hotlines for child abuse and other kinds of things, but ultimately that can be supportive. Ultimately, I think it's going to be funneled down to the local area to provide the support that's required, the legal issues that are going to be dealt with, which are going to be on a local level. Certainly some of the national organizations can be there for support. At JSAFE, we get calls from people who are looking for help, and we can help refer and counsel and support in a Jewish context, but ultimately the kinds of really hands-on support they're going to need are going to be on the local level.
Thank you. And I just want to thank our presenters. And I know that our audience will agree that you've given us a lot to think about and perhaps will help us all in our work. Our next call is going to be on December 7th. Jackson Katz will present strategies for inspiring men and boys to be allies in gender violence prevention. And I want to thank all of our participants on this call. I'm going to be sending you an email when we get off. And please send it back to me and fill out the evaluation. And I've also included on that email websites and information from our presenters so that if you have questions for them or would like more information, their websites will be sent to you so that you'll have a way to get in touch with them. So thank you all again. I look forward to seeing you or hearing from you on Thursday, December 7th. Bye-bye.
Thank you.